In the Edenverse, we're going to help you understand the Bible through the lens of the original audience. I'm Nathan.
And I'm Karen, and we hope you enjoy this episode.
We're back this week with Dr. Scott Booth, who is on faculty at the Pillar Seminary in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yep.
And every summer digs in Israel at Abel
Bet Ma'aka.
Bet Ma'aka. I keep mispronouncing it, but there you go.
You should memorize it because it is the most significant site in all of Israel.
Everyone should come volunteer next summer.
Yeah.
Ma'aka. Translate that for us. What does that mean?
the field of the house of Ma'aka.
There you go.
Ma'aka. There you go. And the other voice you're hearing is John Harmon, who is a PhD student at Southwestern Seminary. John, welcome, man.
Thank you.
So we ended our last episode talking about what can we know from archaeology, but I'd love to just toss it to you guys and say, what kind of major contributions has archaeology given to us to help us understand the world of the ancient Near East, and then obviously specifically for our audience, help us read scripture more accurately? I know we ended the last episode with an example of that, but what are some ones that are like, hey, when this happened, it like metaphorically shook the ground?
I think one of the big things is it shows us how interconnected the ancient world was, because when we read what texts we have from the ancient world, most people tend to assume that it was these little totally isolated pockets of civilization, but it was a lot more cosmopolitan than you might assume. There was trade, there was communication. You know, we have letters from Hittite kings in Egypt and from Ugaritic kings in Hattusha, and there was a lot of commerce and communication going on. So it was really one big interconnected world. Most of what I'm talking about here is in the Late Bronze Age, which is a little earlier.
The Late Bronze Age is when?
It's kind of the end of the patriarchal period. Most people put the Exodus at the end of the Late Bronze Age.
And you mentioned like the Hittites and then Ugaritic texts and the Egyptians. And it, like, just for our audience who doesn't have a map maybe in front of them.
Right. So Egypt, of course, is where it's always been, but the Hittite Empire was in what's now Turkey, and then the Ugaritic Kingdom was in the eastern Mediterranean. Yeah, right. But yeah, that's one big thing we get from it, is sort of a bigger picture of this large interconnected world that you might not realize.
Yeah. A lot of our people have read the Bible. They may have a lot of questions about what in the world is going on in the Bible. And then a lot of them have read or they've been trained to read it devotionally. So I'm just going to get this verse, and what does this mean for me today? And thank you, Lord, and shut the book. And when I teach this class to paint the picture of the world of the Bible and what's going on historically and the various major movements in history through that time, almost every single time I do that, people come up and they're like, man, I had no idea,
there were other people there?
Yes, there were. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Actually, the Israelite tribe, or the Israelite tribes, which eventually was a nation, was really small.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, big things going on.
Well, and I think that speaks to, just a fail on the church's part of not giving, believers an adequate understanding of the historical context that was going on at that day and age. And so we can look at that and be like, it's so frustrating that you just want to read it as a devotional, help me. But it's the same way for the church.
It's intellectually inconsistent. It's these people weren't real, but God helped me in my real.
Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't make the better you understand that stuff and realize that's that was on the ground stuff. Mm-hmm. The whole point of the text is it was on the ground. It happened. So therefore it can also happen for you, or therefore you behave a certain way. Mm-hmm.
So Scott, what are some of the major things that you've seen just in maybe we'll just keep it in the last decade to 20 years in archaeology that you're like, hey, this is a pretty substantive find that helps us understand this in this way?
Okay, so I'm giggling because our answer to that question is going to be far less sexy. what goes immediately into my head is stuff household archaeology. Mm-hmm. I just find what life was like for just average. You can jump into the life of an, like we, we came down at Avel, we came down in some lady's kitchen and her dishes were there still, and her oven and what she had last cooked in it before she left. We came at another, well, earlier phase of the site, different part of the site. Some lady had stashed her jewelry slightly under the floor, right? And it's just their world. So the more we can put together what daily life was like, and even regionally, in Israel, in the north, the south. What about the other side of the Jordan? Could you tell the difference? Like, if you brought a Moabite into Judah, like, how would you know?
Yeah.
Do they behave differently? Do they live differently? Would they have felt weird? Like, just asking those kind of questions and being able to get that information. That's one of the things that I really geek out about.
Yeah.
The other part that I really like is knowing that the shifts that are happening politically, sometimes they have huge impact on the ground, and sometimes it's just surface ripple. Mm. So, like, if you read scripture in Kings, it talks about the Arameans in Israel are fighting over the area around Galilee and the Hula Valley up north, right? And that area swaps hands several times politically. Well, what impact did that have for people on the ground? What did it look like if an empire came, if you're on the ground and a new empire came?
Mm-hmm.
What impact did that have for you?
Yeah.
And what about Babylon? Was there a difference between when Babylon came and when Assyria came? Mm-hmm. What did that feel like?
Mm-hmm.
So being able to get into that world, that to me is some of the most, once you start getting that stuff, and like the stuff at Dan that we talked about last time, where you're like, oh, shoot, on the ground, mm-hmm. it doesn't look like what I thought it would
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in a sense, a lot of the ground rumbling stuff is the stuff that challenges your assumptions and makes you revisit the things you had thought. So household stuff does that for me.
Yeah, so give us some examples of what that looks like. For the average just person trying to make a living, farm the land kind of thing, when the Assyrians come, what does that feel like? And then when the Assyrians leave and the Babylonians come, what does that feel like? And how do we know?
That's what I'm working on, because I don't know that world.
Yeah, that's fine.
But if you back up to figure out, what does it look like when Israel enters the land?
Mm-hmm.
Or
during the out of the desert conquest type.
Right. And what changed and what didn't change? Mm-hmm. And when can you actually first start detecting there's a new people group here?
Yep.
And what does that look like? Or the area I spent my dissertation on, I did the same basic kind of questions, but further north in Syria. And so when you look at Israel coming into the land, it doesn't look all that different. There's a growth of population. There's some house stuff and a few possible pottery forms. But other than that,
maybe a different diet.
Right.
As
right.
we would
but other than
in the
that,
Bible.
It's the transition of this new people into the land, blip on the radar locally. Mm-hmm. If you're in the land and you didn't leave or get slaughtered, which would be most people,
mm-hmm.
then you would just think that there's some new folks here.
Mm-hmm.
That's so crazy, because if we're reading Joshua, we're like, they slaughtered all these people and they settled this land and everybody. Yeah. And so it's like, that feels crazy.
So then you go back and read Joshua and you discover the dude had two major campaigns, one in the north, one in the south. He never exited really the hill country, right? And he only took out some major zones. And even then in Deuteronomy, it says, don't wipe out stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Don't. Why would you destroy cities? They should be empty and you can go walk in there. So archaeologically, we find that there's really not that much of a difference between them. And actually, a similar thing takes place farther north in Syria as the Hittite Empire collapses.
Yeah.
Well, what does it look like when an empire collapses? And there's a decrease in the abilities on the land. And there's actually an influx of people that you can kind of detect for a moment, and then it just goes away and they get back to normal life. And so,
yeah, so probably our audience is, at least some of them are going, well, does that mean like Joshua is not historical? You know?
Right.
And so address that. If it's like, hey, is Joshua historical? And if so, then how does what you guys have found cause us to reevaluate how we read that book? And Judges, too. I mean, that whole period.
So Joshua, at one point, when you first read it, like you said, it can feel like this giant like influx of people, blah, blah, blah.
They drive everybody out.
Yeah,
and now the land's empty.
Right,
they're resettling
right.
it. Yeah.
But there's a couple things that are wrong with that. One, we've learned since then that it's it's kind of illiterate of us to think that. They're writing in a particular genre, mm-hmm. conquest account,
yep.
and it's very hyperbolic. It's well known in the ancient world.
Yep.
We just forgot to apply it when we read Joshua.
Yeah.
We're like, we do it when we read Egyptian accounts and Assyrian and Hittite.
A good example is we have the inscription from an Egyptian king, Merneptah, who says he completely wiped out Israel.
Right, right. Yeah.
And what he meant is he fought them and he won.
But maybe
literally
just barely.
Didn't wipe them out.
Yeah. His seed is no more.
Yeah, right.
It's the way you talk about it. It's the way you do these.
Well, and it's interesting because in Joshua, when he talks about we totally annihilated whatever, and then like
but those
a few
who
verses
left.
Later, yeah. a few verses later, those people are, he's talking about interacting with them.
And they're not stupid. They know they're doing it.
Yep.
They're playing the rules of the game. It's just like there are rules for genres, mm-hmm. just like there are rules for genres in film, right? Like, you know, two guys are standing opposite each other and like tumbleweed goes across. Like mm-hmm. in The Matrix, right? Mm-hmm. They play by these rules mm-hmm. when Neo and what's the other guy's name?
Agent Smith.
Yeah. And then the newspaper blows between them. They're like, they're signaling to you there's about to be a big fight, right?
Yeah.
So like there are signals in that text that tell you how to read it. And we just forgot to do it. So that's mm-hmm. part one of the Joshua stuff.
Yeah.
The second part is, again, archaeologically, you go through and there's really only a claim that three sites are destroyed. Mm-hmm. If you read the book, like utterly flattened.
Mm-hmm.
And this Jericho Ai, which is just a place.
Yeah.
And then Hazor.
And which, what's the third one?
Hazor,
yeah.
Or but Hazor.
We tend to focus on wiping people out because that's so shocking mm-hmm. to us. But the text really talks more about killing kings, mm-hmm. not wiping out whole populations.
That's right.
So it seems like it might have been more about breaking a power structure than it was wiping out a whole population.
Yeah, exactly. And there's not this doesn't have anything to do with like ethnicity. It seems like it's more of a, hey, I want you to drive out all of the things that are not
the toxic
pure Yahwist worship.
Yeah, they're getting rid of all the toxic elements. So Joshua, you should read the book of Joshua as a foothold. It's just the stage one to, we accomplished the beginning of the story,
mm-hmm.
right? We got in the land. Hooray. And it's told in a big hooray way. But if you
look at how awesome we are, we are not
right.
Yeah.
Pick up the book of Judges, read Judges 1, and it's like,
yeah.
all right.
Yeah,
Well, read Judges 1, but you need a map. Or Google the sites, and you're like, there's this list of all these sites. They're like, yeah, we didn't do it.
Yeah,
and then
just kidding.
And then the rest of the book is a theological treatise on, and look what happens.
What happens when you don't worship that way?
Yeah, and when you let the toxic element in, a little yeast is the idea of the book, right? And so you watch it turn the entire loaf.
Until the end, they're in a civil war.
Right. And so the archaeology, so that's what the claim of the text is. And I actually find that the way Judges talks about that period of history, which I take to be 1200-ish to 1050-ish,
mm-hmm.
right? That time period.
Late Bronze Iron Age transition.
Yeah.
That's another important detail that people don't realize was this was a collapse and post-collapse society. So they were living in Mad Max times.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
But that really informs the text because
it does. Egypt had been controlling all of that territory and then slowly pulling back, right? And then in the book of Judges, the theological claim is keep pushing those guys out. Mm-hmm. But because you didn't and you looked more and more like them, it corrupted your entire society such that you read the end of the book of Judges and you hate it. You're supposed to hate the end, by the way. So when you look at it on the ground, it plays out just like that. Like you can almost, so in archaeology, one of the mistakes that was made early on was, look, we don't see any evidence of Israel being here.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore the Bible isn't true.
Isn't true, yeah.
But the Bible's saying there's no evidence we were here because we completely
look
molded.
Like everybody else.
We did everything. Yeah. So you'll go and find all the same kind of cultic behavior, for example. And you're like, look, there's nothing different. There's nothing different. And that's the point.
Yeah, well, as I sit here listening to you, I don't know, as an average Joe person, if I'm reading Joshua, now I'm like, I feel deceived. Like, how dare they write it in a style that I didn't fully understand and I can't interpret it correctly, therefore. And so what does our average reader do with that, with the Bible? And so how do we understand that Joshua was a conquest text and therefore it was written as such. And so we shouldn't take it quite literally.
Yeah. And I think to add to that real quickly, one of the questions that I get when I do start to unpack a lot of the contextual stuff around the scriptures is how in the world was I supposed to know this?
Yeah.
You know, so like, am I really at fault for interpreting some way when I'm not in the dirt digging, you know, to find all this stuff out. So what do you say to those people?
It's the job of the academy to get that stuff out to you. So it's not a failure on your part. It's a failure on the academy to be slow. But also there's an element that's not failure because the stuff we're learning, I mean, you had to dig up all these texts, right? And we had to learn them and we had to once you learn the Assyrian stuff and then you learn the Hittite and then you learn the Egyptian, someone's got to come along and say, wait a second.
Yeah.
I see a genre here. And then once they do that, it's got to run its course in the academy. Mm-hmm. People say, they fight about, is he correct? Is he not? Or is she correct? Is she not? And then once that, then we'll put it to the church. So sometimes it just takes a while for us to learn. This text wasn't written to you. It's for you, but it's not to you. So yeah. That's
a huge point that we should, again, say. It wasn't written to you, but it is for you.
Yeah, yeah. So it takes some effort. It's another culture.
Give the academy time.
What do you want? You want everything to be written to a 21st century American?
Like, yes.
Get over yourself. The faith community is older than you.
Yeah.
But that also doesn't mean that it's completely inaccessible.
That's right.
I think we can get a lot broader, richer picture by understanding the ancient context. But you can still get the theological point without knowing all that stuff. Yeah.
That's right.
You read Judges and you still come away going, man, I better worship the Lord
and not
be pulled into these other things or else this bad stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we gain a picture in DL's world? If we're sitting here, like for me, how do I find access to some of the things that y'all are learning? How do I understand?
You mean in terms of resources?
Resources, yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of good publications that are really accessible to the average person. There's like the Biblical Archaeologist is a good periodical. It's written for the average reader, but from a well-informed perspective. There are a couple of archaeological study Bibles. There was one that just came out that several of my professors contributed to, so I want to give that a little plug.
And what's that one called?
The ESV Study Bible came out a couple of years ago. But it's actually...
Just the standard English Standard Version, or is it actually like ESV Archaeology Edition?
Yeah, ESV Archaeological Study Bible or something to that effect. Yeah. But that's actually a really good resource that is the Bible, but it has commentary written by archaeologists to kind of help inform the text. And that's something that's really... readily accessible for the average person.
So I'm just going to give you guys a chance to nerd out here. And what are some things that you guys are working on that you're excited about?
Well, I'm really excited about, so the site that we're both involved with of El Beit Ma'akah, it's physically a huge site in the north of Israel. And we're just starting to scratch the surface of it. And I'm really excited about seeing how that excavation informs the regional world.
Where is it?
So it's in the very farthest north of Israel in what's called the Hula Valley.
Like north of Dan?
A bit. I think it's a couple miles north and west of Dan.
Oh, that same area. That
yeah,
same
just
general area.
Right in the same area.
And why, Scott, you started off at one point saying it was the most significant dig in all of Israel. What makes it that?
Prove.
Defend your statement, man.
First of all, you have to go and volunteer to know. And also...
and give us money.
Yeah, yeah. You have to donate, and then you'll discover.
Yeah.
Some of the secrets will be unlocked at that point.
Yeah. It's funny.
I think that the site is really significant because you get a view into part of the early kingdom phase of Israel that we don't get in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. And it's a really, so for example, like during the time of David and Saul, it was a hopping site, really, really active. And you look at how the things that David was up against in the book of Samuel, and it's helping us understand that. Also, it's in that region that I said earlier was kind of went ping pong back and forth between two kingdoms. And so you get to see on the ground, what does it look like when a site has that happen? And they are culturally oriented, not towards Israel, even though they're part of the kingdom. So like seeing all that stuff work out, which are all elements in the text, in the biblical text. I think it's actually quite important to see how all that plays out.
And it's also significant that it's a crossroads site. It's right at the point where Israelite culture encounters Aramean culture and also encounters Phoenician culture.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we see a lot of that interplay of
So was this a fairly large, comparatively in the day, like an urban center or... Because you're making it sound like it's like an intersection of multiple
part of its history.
It seems to have been a pretty significant city.
Yeah.
For part of its history. Mm-hmm. And I should say, like, when we have cities, like when we say words like, well, we're here in Dallas, right? So if you say LA, you trigger culture. You know what that means. You do everything from culture to politics to you know demographics. Do the same thing with New York, Chicago. We say Seattle. Saying Seattle means something totally different to you than saying Tampa Bay, right? But when we read the Bible, a lot of times we read it real flat. Mm-hmm. It's just city, 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 city. Mm-hmm. They don't mean anything. Mm-hmm. But when an author would have said Avel or any of the cities up there, it would have triggered for them a whole culture and a whole world that all of the audience would have known. And until we understand what that is, we have an incomplete picture.
Yeah.
Of what the claims are that are being made, or even what David was up against. So digging a site that is as significant as Avel, that was so significant in early Iron Age during the time of David, is super important.
Yeah.
It's really helpful. That means we shouldn't skip over the list of cities when we're reading.
Yeah, there's also a lot of
information there that people don't catch.
Like, there's other things, like you see Lachish, like, that's a hugely important site, but we read over it as if it's nothing. And like, it's important cultically.
It's a bunch of foreign names, but it has a lot of information.
There is a ton of information. And when it gets in certain lists and not other lists, like, that matters. The Bible is assuming that you're doing that math when it's talking about stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And I think as you're listening to this, I think some of the major takeaways I'm getting from you guys is let the text be the text in its context. So hold loosely your assumptions, your presuppositions that you bring to the text. And I think as you start to get into this kind of world, then you realize what your presuppositions are. And like you said earlier, like, hey, name them, just call them what they are and acknowledge that they're there. But don't allow your presupposition to be the thing that drives the meaning of the text. Like, let the text be the text. Let it be what it is. And hold it loosely. That doesn't mean you're not a Christian anymore. It doesn't mean that you're not evangelical or whatever. Actually, it means you're just starting to like do good Bible study.
Right.
And so let the tension be there. It's okay. And then the other thing I'm hearing is, hey, and also if you want to actually like get involved in this, you can.
Totally.
Yeah.
So let the audience know, like, hey, if you are interested in going and being a part of a dig, how does that happen? What are some first steps to do that?
Yeah, most people don't realize that many digs are primarily staffed by volunteers, and anybody can go do it. And
with zero experience or knowledge
of anything. If you can walk up a hill carrying a shovel, we can teach you how to dig.
Yeah.
And so you can
go break some stuff.
Yeah. Well, we try to minimize that, but you know, but you can,
which is what I did. I mean, I did that in college. Yeah. I had no previous experience.
Broke all kinds.
And I did. Yeah. It's wrecking the house, man.
Anybody can come spend a week or 4 weeks on a dig and, we'll teach you what to do. But the site that we dig at, Avel Beit Macha, we have a website. Is it just avelbeitmacha.org?
I think there's some hyphens in there, but Macha is M-A-A-C-A-H.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Yeah. Is there like an email? I mean, I'm sure on that website.
I believe there's a contacts on that site.
Yeah.
Or if they can always you can go to the Pillar Seminary site and send me an email. And I'll help you get connected.
Yeah, if you're interested in this and you want to get further involved, then for sure, reach out to these guys. I'm sure they'll put you to work.
Yeah, and then Bob Mullins will take you on tours on the weekends.
Yeah.
And he is wicked good.
I love it.
Yeah, that's worth the price of admission.
That's cool.
And you know, we keep throwing out the name of the site where we dig, Avel Beit Macha. And
what's the name?
Avel Beit Macha. But I was just going to clarify that, you know, that's a Hebrew and Aramaic name, and a lot of people aren't going to know what we're saying, but To the English reader, it looks like Abel, Beth, Maacah, M-A-A-C-A-A. Just to clarify that, when we're telling people to look this stuff up, and then we're rattling off Hebrew words like
it's everybody. Abel, Beth, Maacah.
There you go.
Exactly.
That's how they say it over there. Beautiful. Sorry, we've been saying it wrong.
I mean, I am from Arkansas, so whatever.
You've been listening to Edenverse. If you like what you heard, subscribe, tell your friends, give us a rating. If you have questions, email us at podcast@edenteam.org. If you want to know more about our organization, visit our website at theedenproject.com. Lastly, check out all of our other podcasts. Thanks for spending part of your day with us, and remember, God loves you. Bye.
Peace.